This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to the show. It's 6 a.m. and I'm Julian Ng. Together with me, my partner in crime, Sharad Kutan.
Oh, no, not crime.
Partner in crime, Sharad Kutan. Thank you for joining us this morning. And of course, as usual, we have an exciting day of shows lined up for you. On the breakfast grill is Munira Khairuddin, CEO of CIMB Principal Asset Management. And she's going to speak to Ibrahim Sunny. And Sharad, CIMB Principal, one of the largest fund management and unit trust company in the world, private, I must add, because the largest one is government-owned, which is EPF, and some of the other government-owned fund management houses. But this is a private one, and it's under one of the biggest banks in Malaysia, CIMB Bank, in fact, the second largest bank in Malaysia. So this is the asset management arm, and I think the future of asset management in Malaysia, you can look at it from many angles. A lot of challenges there, not to mention fintech that has been such a buzzword lately.
Right. So when you say asset management, they're investing in stocks and bonds around the world locally. Do they have the same
issue? They peddle unit trusts. So if you want to buy into a collective investment scheme, then they're one of the guys to go to, one of the major ones.
Do they have the same issues that you often bring up in regard to EPF about the distribution of their investments, local and domestic and international?
Well, yes, they do. I think they have a high concentration of investments in Malaysia, but I think that's not my only bugbear with them. The other one, which is the cost, right? The cost of buying into the unit trust, extremely expensive. I think commissions, sales-related commissions that are charged to you in the first year, 5%, 3 to 5%, anywhere in that range. And when you add the annual management fee of 1.5% to 2%, you can see how in the first year, the amount of money that go into costs is around 7%, and that's huge.
Well, isn't that kind of willing buyer, willing seller, as long as somebody who's investing is fully aware of these costs and they are willing to take that on?
True, and the fund management houses would argue that as long as they deliver the performance, you should be okay with that, paying all those things. But the point is, do they always deliver the performance? And secondly, is it a closed industry where if every fund management house charges the same kind of commission levels and equally expensive, whether this is a closed market and whether people would have the alternative to go somewhere else? And I think that's why the ETFs, which have been so popular in the United States recently, has garnered a lot of funds because they're extremely cheap. And ETFs are only beginning to take shape in Malaysia in a very, very small way. And it's not enough yet to fulfill the kind of demands for investable funds that there are out there in Malaysia.
So, the law of the market, as it were, do you think that with the challenges from fintech, with this passive investing strategies through ETFs, that what you're looking at is pressure on these types of instruments that they will either have to change or they will die, a natural death?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the catalyst for that would be the millennials, which are currently also a small part of the market because they don't have a lot of money, or at least they don't have as much money as the very more higher income group that give a lot of money to unit trusts. But the millennials, because they are more sensitive to the kind of information that's available online, and they're more open to looking into this kind of disruptive products on their own, they would be the catalyst to drive this kind of thing.
I mean, there are, the previous generations, as it were, for whom the wisdom, the conventional wisdom was you put your money in fixed deposit. It was the sensible thing to do, right? And perhaps that conventional wisdom is surely, and steadily being eroded by this idea that, well, you should get bang for your buck when you do your investments, and there are, platforms out there that will help you do it. I mean, I watch on television all these, strange ads of somebody fly fishing and they're both talking about investments, or somebody comes for a date and then the date says, did you hear about that NATO plane going down and, the markets are going crazy? And hold on, honey, I'm going to start you know, trading now because I can trade on multiple platforms in different markets simultaneously and things like that. I mean, yeah, it's really a lot of instruments out there that are kind of dealing with the current realities, right?
Actually, the kind of instruments that are available to Malaysia, to Malaysians, are kind of still vanilla. So you don't have a lot of very exotic options. But also, when you look at the amounts that are, the figures that are available from Bank Negara, the amounts that are in fixed deposit accounts amount to trillions of dollars. So a big part of that is still held by the older, richer generation. And it would remain in those accounts without the you know, need to mobilize them. They don't see the need to mobilize those accounts because they just want something very safe, right? So you can see the potential that's available in Malaysia to go into things like robo-advisors. I think the potential is fantastic.
What about art? I mean, Julian, would you ever invest in art? Because I think there's some claims that made that, you know, investing in contemporary art or artworks really does have does bring a good return. And if you, you know your art history, if you, you know, have a, you know, you have the due diligence, you could actually make a killing in the art world by buying choice pieces and holding on to them. And they look pretty too on your wall or on a plinth.
I would buy art. I don't know whether I would invest in art because I think a major principle that is underlying art investment is the fact that it's predicated on the principle that you have to be lucky. So you got to buy the right one, right? Otherwise, I don't know whether there are art funds out there which would provide you the kind of required diversification to make an efficient investment. But if you went out there to buy one piece of art for 50,000 ringgit, you got to make sure that that works out well. And this is
But there's always risk, isn't it? I mean, a friend of mine said to me the other day, he bought a work 25 years ago for 3,000 ringgit. It was said to be, everybody said, my God, you're spending 3,000 ringgit on an artwork. It's now valid, it's now valued at 200,000.
But was he lucky or was it the standard behavior of all art pieces?
Well, no. Actually, in some ways he's lucky. But at that point, that artist was up and coming. The only thing that could have really cut short the return on investment would be if the artist died too young before he developed a body of art, which is necessary to make artworks valuable, right? So this whole sense that this is a history of an artist or their works have art historical value. But yeah, it's a risky game, like everything else, I guess.
You know, from what you're saying, you're suggesting that there is a way to game the system, but I think there is. It's very hard. And you can replace art with any other investment on what you just said. You can replace it with houses, you can replace it with stocks, for example, and it would apply in the same way, right? You hope that something would do well before its time is up. But an efficient investment is something where you're able to diversify and to make that a little bit more efficient by holding, let's say, 50 stocks or 100 pieces of art in the portfolio rather than just one piece where it's akin to putting all your eggs into one basket.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. I think some sort of diversity in your holdings will be good for you in the long run.
Okay, just having a look at the other shows in our lineup, Current Affairs, we yesterday spoke to Phil Robertson of the Human Rights Watch on the exploitation of migrant workers in Malaysia. I think this is a very hot issue in Malaysia. So today on Current Affairs, we explore the management of foreign workforce and Malaysia's dependence on them.
Yeah, we're speaking to somebody from the Malaysian Employers Federation to get their side of this fascinating story. I mean, this is a story for many countries that rely on importing large numbers of foreign workers. I mean, Singapore is an example of an importing country in the region. I think Brunei would also be one of those countries. And of course, you see a lot of the Middle Eastern countries also have huge, and it's structural, right? I mean, if their economies are going to survive and grow, they need foreign workers. The question is, then what kind of rights do these give their foreign workers? What kind of thinking goes behind their integration into society. And you see some examples of, you know, of countries not wanting to integrate foreign worker populations into their own, you know, and denying them access to things like marriage. Because obviously people fall in love across these barriers, you know, regardless of your passport. And the models, you know, there are all kinds of responses to the issue of foreign labor for those countries that are importing foreign labor.
Do you think it's a kind of modern-day slavery that a lot of these migrant workers are put into? Because we very oftentimes, we don't actively oppose their rights, but what we do is worse, we ignore the kind of situations that they're going through, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the migrant story is so varied. You see that in the U.S., with, you know, a generation that really did suffer, that was exploited. And then their children enter the schooling system. They become integrated. They get citizenship. They do well, you know, and it's sort of a generational story as well. I was in Bangladesh recently, Julian, as you know, and there's a town in Bangladesh called Sylhet, and it's kind of like Cameron Highlands of Bangladesh. Beautiful, hilly. And it's called the London of Bangladesh because many of the people of Sylhet relocated to London and England. And, you know, and their wealth was repatriated. So the whole landscape of Sylhet in some ways reflects the aspirations of those who've done well. You know, Bangladeshis who've done well. And you think of people like Akram Khan, the you know, kind of world-renowned choreographer of Bangladeshi stock. And so the story, yes, there is a story of exploitation, but there's also the story of dreams and hopes, you know, that built nations. I mean, Australia is built on migrant workers, America. You know, and so I think it's a complex story with winners and losers.
Mm-hmm. I think America is something that is of slight difference, but of relevance to us as well when we consider how we deal with these migrant workers. Because I've started reading this book called The New Jim Crow, which is about America is using the system of prisons and criminal justice system and mass incarceration to develop a new form of slavery against the blacks. So they've moved from a period of the history where slavery was accepted and then it became unaccepted, which resulted in that civil war. And today, the remnants of those people who supported slavery, and this may be a very extreme thing to say, but if you read the book, you can see how they point out that there are certain political forces that tries to perpetuate enslavement of the blacks in America through their criminal justice system. And you see that a huge chunk of the black community over there have been through that criminal justice system and therefore unable to find jobs today, unable to be to vote, unable to be declared all the rights of a normal citizen. And that is a new form of that kind of
segregation and subjugation. In fact, 30 years ago, I read a book with the word new in it. It was called The New Helots, H-E-L-O-T-S. And, you know, it comes from the Greek word for a subjugated population. And it was a description of these new forms of migration, global forms of trajectories of migration that result in permanent subjugation for community. So the thing is, you can't get rid, say, for instance, your economic structures are predicated on foreign labor, right? So they're going to be a permanent feature. So once they're a permanent feature, how temporary, I mean, can their rights also be temporary if the situation is of permanence, right? And that's the big dilemma for a lot of these countries and economies.
Yeah, so we're really looking at whether there is an orchestrated something orchestrated to keep labor prices down. With the Jim Crow Act at the time, they made a law that all after slavery and after all these people were emancipated, they made a law that it is against the law not to have a job. And so everyone who was then freed had to go and look for a job which returned them to the original situation. And I'm just wondering whether we're having those kind of machinations here today in our own backyard.
Yeah, I think there's a concept of the reserve army of labor, right? The idea that, in fact, labor surpluses can be used as a tool to suppress the working person and the working class. So, yeah, interesting questions for the economy in the 21st century. It sounds like the 20th century.
Okay, just talking about that, let's just quickly go through the other pieces of news that are we found today. The former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan says he would not describe the violence being committed against Myanmar's Rohingyas minority as genocide. He thinks there are tension, there has been fighting, but he wouldn't put it in those same words to describe a genocidal situation.
Yeah. So Kofi Annan was asked in August by Myanmar's de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi to lead a commission into the tensions in the Rakhine State, and that's an ongoing initiative. And in fact, the Myanmar government, in its criticism of the Malaysian government's government, has said that there are two commissions that they have initiated. Question is it ethnic cleansing or is it not? And who's going to determine that? Who's going to be the honest broker in that story?
It's 6:16. You're listening to The Morning Run with Sharad Kudin and myself, Julian Ng. We'll be back with more news, BFM 89.9. That's Aretha Franklin there with Baby, I Love You. BFM 89.9, The Morning Run continues with Sharad Kudin and myself, Julian Ng. And of course, we are giving you some love as far as the news is concerned for today. And also later on after the 9:30 news, S&M will come on, and this is a show about stocks and markets. And today we take a further look at the recently announced Bank Negara measures to support the ringgit with none other than Noor Hisham Hussein of the EPF. Of course, a very knowledgeable guy trying to provide some flesh to some of Bank Negara's measures. A lot of negativity about what was announced, especially coming from the exporters. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, he is the first Japanese PM to visit Pearl Harbor. He said that he wouldn't apologize for Japan's attack, and this is on the anniversary of the attack of the Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, I think this couple of days, I'm looking on the websites about when exactly the Pacific War started, meaning Pacific War being the kind of the Asian or Pacific side of World War II. And so it's either dated 7th or 8th or 9th. The invasion of Malaya, British Malaya, if you remember, Japanese soldiers landing in Kelantan and cycling down the peninsula, that happened at midnight on December the 8th. So we're in that period where people do commemorate this. The question of apologies, I think, are interesting because they have legal ramifications as well.
Totally.
So, if you apologize, then you might be, you open yourself up to what is it? Compensation, right? And so I think that is an issue perhaps that underscores why a prime minister might or might not apologize. It could be in any institution.
He's got to look at policy, and he can't just shoot off his mouth like some presidents we know.
Yeah, and also I think there's also this issue, Julian, of how people feel about the past, right? And if you apologize, do you dishonor those of your citizens who did sacrifice their lives, even if it was seen now as a mistake? Those Japanese imperial soldiers who did, in their own world, sacrifice their lives for this idea of a greater Japan, and its imperial ambitions, right? So they are, because the Yakuzuni shrine is the other source of controversy. Every time a Japanese prime minister goes to the Yakuzuni memorial.
There's a global uproar.
Yeah, there is a global uproar. And that, of course, is because he's got to appease some segment of Japanese society that says, well, whatever it is, you have to honor the dead. And in this case, the dead might be war criminals, but okay. So complex issues around these matters.
Okay, in Hong Kong, there is a different kind of invasion, but a happier one, because a pair of lions guarding the HSBC building, very iconic building, has been given a rainbow-coloured makeover. And the replicas of these two lions have been painted as part of the bank's celebration of pride, celebrate unity to support the LGBT movement.
Right. So this is a campaign. And I think, you know, and as the story suggests, in some countries, this would be uncontroversial. Not just the question of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender rights, but also the question of corporates sponsoring a social campaign. And so there are two parts of the story, which is one, the substantive issue of the particular rights that are being championed, and the other thing of, do corporates have a role? Should they come out and state their preferences in terms of social and cultural policy, right? And where society is going.
If you've visited Hong Kong and if you've been to the HSBC building, it is, I mean, truly iconic. And if you go inside, there are very maverick ways of how they design the internal building, that you can change the walls just to make room for something and expand rooms and so on. But at the bottom of the building is this whole vast expanse of a foyer. And it is truly a melting pot, because on normal working days, people would just go out there, hang out, you know, have their lunch, sit around. And over the weekend, you can see a lot of the Filipino or other migrant workers who are having employment in Hong Kong. I mean, fill up the whole place. And which is kind of like a message that in the same way that's answering your question about whether the corporates play this kind of activism, right? Whereas this is being played in an extremely subtle way, because they have provided that space for community and for communal living.
That's fascinating. You know, my first trip to Hong Kong, Julian, I was surprised by the fact that, you know, I had like this, I don't know, it was Indian or Nepali fella, you know, who's, you know, security guard at the airport saying to me, brother, where are you from? You know, and also just landing in, you know, near my hotel, you know, and next to Chung Kee Mansion, and seeing these sari-clad women, and then only to discover later on they're actually sex workers. And so sari-clad sex workers in Hong Kong. And I was like, oh, wow, that's fascinating, you know.
To some interesting places in Hong
Kong.
Well,
you know, and Chung Kee Mansion, if you watch the movie, a lot of foreigners in that. So Hong Kong is a global city, you know, it's not Chinese, and you know, and who built Hong Kong is a global story, not necessarily ethnic Chinese.
Yeah. So talking about community, also in Australia, the Fremantle Council last month decided to move the traditional Australia Day events from the 26th to 28th January because of Aboriginal cultural sensitivities. What is this about, Shirai?
Well, so there's an attempt by a local council to be culturally sensitive, right? And now there's been a pushback on that. And the assistant immigration minister has come out to say citizenship has got to be apolitical, non-commercial, bipartisan and secular. And by suggesting that you can't, you know, chop and change and have local variations on this. And so this is an ongoing story about the place of Aboriginal society in larger Australian society, what's happened to them, you know, over the years. And also, you know, over the years, whether prime ministers, Australian prime ministers, apologised to the Aboriginal community for the kind of policies, many of them which are quite horrendous, destroying Aboriginal families and such. So, yeah, so that's just another story. And I put it there in the mix, Julian, because I thought, hey, you know, a lot of Malaysians love Australia. It's the land of milk and honey. They might be interested in the story.
Okay, it's 6:28 and we have this very interesting story about the making of a truly Chinese global blockbuster by none other than Chinese filmmaker Zhang Yimou. But there is something quite surprising about this, Shirat.
Yeah, the controversy is Matt Damon's in it, right? And so Matt Damon isn't apparently isn't Chinese.
So, and so this is a Chinese movie about China, but with Matt Damon in it.
Well, Matt Damon plays a foreign mercenary. So for Chang Yimou, this is natural. I mean, he's a foreign mercenary.
How surprising, a foreign mercenary.
Yeah, and you know, and well, some are saying, well, he, Chang Yimou, the director, is being mercenary because he put Matt Damon in order to break into the American and European markets. And now, okay. Yeah,
because Matt Damon is obviously a crowd puller, right?
Absolutely. So is that bad? Does it make it any less Chinese to have Matt Damon taking a starring lead?
I mean, it's realistic. I mean, the world doesn't just exist in a vacuum, and it's not just a closed-up country. So the fact that you put in one of those token Caucasian people.
Ah, so the question is whether he's token or not. And that, I think that's, it's on that that the controversy rides, whether Matt Damon's position is tokenistic or in fact is crucial to the story.
I think from a more mercenary viewpoint, i.e. go up the corporate organizational structure, the Chinese are becoming more and more savvy about how to break into the American market. And they have made huge acquisitions in the U.S. over the last 2 years. And this is one of those ways where, you know, they can invade the huge American market for new forms of content and social media. And it's 6:30 and we have the news coming up with Lynn Mark. BFM 89.9, you're with Morning Run, and that was We Belong by Pat Benatar. You're with Sharad Kutin and myself, Julian Ng. Now, are you having enough sleep? And if you're not, how much would you pay for a good night's sleep? Apparently, there is a custom-made continental bed made by four master artisans in Sweden, which has a pinewood frame, steel springs and layers of flax and horsetail hair and cotton and wood batting. The price, $150,000. And I don't even
Well, you know,
know
what, Julian, so right there, you know, I think chances are not only are those four master craftsmen, are they having a good night's sleep? I think
they're
probably laughing all the way to the bank
exactly,
as well.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay, so what's so special
but,
about
But someone, someone worked out the numbers, right? If you keep it for 25 years and get 8 hours of sleep every night, that's like paying only a bargain price of $2 for every hour of sleep that you get.
I wouldn't mind paying $2 or ringgit for every, you know, like good sleep. I think sleep is so important. And I speak as somebody who's personally been sleep deprived for several years now. And
several years. Yeah, okay. That explains a lot.
Absolutely. My chirpy nature in the morning, for starters. But no, okay, what is it about this bed? I mean, so there are four old men working on this bed. I mean, why does it give you better sleep than anything else?
I have no idea. I guess it's
the
material.
The
material that they use. I don't know, actually. It beats me.
Okay, so, you know, I must confess, over the last, say, 20 years, I've slept on really bad beds. Mm-hmm. Or beds that started off reasonably comfortable and then just got increasingly uncomfortable, but it took a lot for me to actually change the mattress, for instance, right? And I more recently bought something that I probably wouldn't have bought years ago, which is slightly more expensive bed. Not as expensive as the bed you mentioned just now, but with all these other things. And again, it was advertised as a bed that it was particularly good for my back, for my bones, for my spine. You know, the whole...
Where did you get it?
I got it at one of these big, kind of retail outlets.
Okay.
I could say the name, Harvey Norman. But I think the point really is, and that's not the brand. I mean, that's just the shop that I got it at. But, and I think even the name of the mattress has this whole idea of being good for your bones and your back kind of thing,
yeah.
Right? And you see that advertised all over the place. I mean, things like pillows that are supposed to help you sleep, specially shaped pillows.
Yes. I have owned many of that because of my faith in this kind of product at that point in time. But
have you lost your faith?
Yeah, because this is something I think about all the time. We didn't have bespoke mattresses before at the dawn of human beings, right? So what did human beings sleep on at that point in time? And I kind of am veering to the belief that it is more what you do when you're awake rather than what you do when you want to go to bed that determines the quality of your sleep. Because if you're active and you're chasing wild animals, hunting, And then you go to bed at night, you can sleep on the top of a tree trunk, and that would be okay for you. So I don't know why it is a modern phenomenon that we need to have the correct bed to sleep on.
Yeah, I think often, you know, there is this one, you know, sort of a, it's a form of thinking, right? You think there is kind of a simple solution to any problem. The problem isn't a result of a complex array of factors, right? So you say, well, the issue is the bed. Or the issue, as you put it, you know, the issue is what you do. Maybe you exercise more every day, you'll sleep better. And it's probably a combination of a whole range of things, because you could exercise a lot in the day and then have really bad habits like watching television
Correct.
Late at night.
Looking at your phone.
Looking at your phone.
The and light then, from the phone is actually very bad
yeah.
for you.
So, you know, more confessions. You know, one of the things that you lose when you have too much light in after sunset, as it were, is that your melatonin levels drop. And the melatonin levels are supposed to increase as light disappears, and that helps with sleep. But because of all this artificial light, you lose melatonin. So I started taking melatonin mm-hmm. As a way of helping me sleep. And because I read it in some magazine, you know, about somebody who had been melatonin. And I think, and because we know of, you know, there are downsides to taking drugs. I mean, this is not a... it's a kind of replacement for a naturally occurring drug in your body, right? So it's not like I'm taking Valium or some other kind of drug to put me to sleep. But did it work? I'm not sure, you know. I really am not sure. Now, I don't take melatonin. I have lavender pouches. So a friend of mine grows lavender.
That's not the answer.
Not in this country.
To your sleepless night, lavender pouches.
What she does is she harvests the lavender and then she creates little pouches and she puts them in. And the smell from the lavender, the aroma, it's supposed to be very good. And, you know, honestly, Julian, I can tell you, the first few nights I had brilliant dreams, which is suggestive of a deep sleep, yeah. right? When I first used the lavender pouch. So now I cling to my little lavender pouches. I crush them to kind of release more oils.
Maybe the lavenders recreated that prehistoric environment that made all the cave people fall asleep. I don't know. Maybe that's the thing, right?
But they were sleeping in fields of lavender.
Exactly, maybe. But, you know, coming back to this 150,000 bed, I think it is a modern phenomenon where people go out there and prey on a need or a desire of people. This is along the same lines of you know, miracle cures, motivational talks, get rich quick schemes, that we want a very quick fix to our lives and the problems that we have. And especially for people who have the money, they are so, and even for people who don't, they are so easily wowed by $150,000 bed.
Yeah, so it's $150,000, which is what? In ringgit now?
Almost half a million ringgit.
More, right? Because we have four times.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Size. Yeah,
it's 600,000, 700,000.
Yes. So you need to be almost a millionaire to buy this mattress.
Yeah, so only a couple of people in the world are going to be able, well, more than a couple of people in the world who will be able to afford this. But it is a very attractive looking bed, I must say.
Which will be covered with some sheets.
Yeah. You know what? You know how people have preferences as to the mattress, whether they want it firm or they want it super soft. And, you know, what was your preference, Julian, if you don't mind sharing it with the world?
I think I'm in between the two, not too hard and not too soft.
Yeah, me too.
I think that's the way to go.
I used to go to hotels.
The Goldilocks idea of a bed.
Didn't she want it very soft?
No, I think she wanted it just nice.
Oh, just nice, which yeah. is, okay, kind of a sweet point between the two.
You know, Sharad, going back to your melatonin, do you think that drugs are a good aid to sleeping? Because research has shown that it is actually not, and in the long term... And you can argue that melatonin is not actually drugs. Melatonin is actually a normal hormone that is produced by your body. But, of course, I don't know if you can produce that synthetically.
But they do.
Except, but on the whole, now researchers are saying that you should throw away all those sleep aids in the form of drugs.
Yeah. So I think what research is saying is that, so you might be, as it were, not awake, but the quality of your sleep might not be the best when you take drugs. So drugs, and also that the side effects, and that drugs stay in your system longer than you intend them to stay. So you're actually awake now, but then you still have the drugs coursing through you and might affect your performance, might have some debilitating effects, let's say, in your ability to drive safely and such. So
it plays out in very much more bad ways and harmful ways in your waking hours and affecting your health.
But, you know, so many people, and it's said about lack of sleep, insomnia and such, is actually killing people. And killing people in our demographic, if you don't mind me including you into this.
Please do.
But, you know, and it's an epidemic apparently in some parts of the world. People not getting enough sleep. And, of course, a lack of sleep results in things like obesity, all kinds of bad things happen as a consequence of not having enough sleep. Because sleep is that time of the day where the body gets to regenerate, your brain gets to regenerate, deal with all the bad stuff. I mean, it's a kind of quarter of your life that is necessary, because obviously, I mean, you think of the body as a self-generating machine. It needs that time, you know, it's downtime. And so, I mean, I continue to look for the holy grail of good sleep. I don't know what is the solution. If you have a solution, perhaps you can tweet us. Yeah, what
Let
is
it,
your particular...
And don't charge us $150,000 for it. Okay, we
hope... Oh my God, Dr. Fu says, I've been sleeping on the couch. I don't know if he means that...
He had some problem with his wife.
I don't know. It's like, Dr. Fu, why are you sleeping on the couch?
Dr. Fu, tell us your secret. Okay, and we hope that we'll keep you awake for the next couple of hours. And the news is coming up next. But first, here is Dreams by Fleetwood Mac, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.